Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Joining me now is Ted Scott, PhD student at UBC in the Department of Geography. You're part of a team that's been studying seasonal change in mid-temperate latitudes. Before we get into the rest of it, what does that mean, mid-temperate latitudes?
Sure, yeah. So the mid-latitudes are really the region north of the tropics in the northern hemisphere up until you get to the polar region. And then in the southern hemisphere, you know, at the southern end of the tropics, down to like just north of Antarctica. And that's, that region is what we explored because that region has a pretty, you know, clear seasonal cycle of what we would call four seasons. The tropics tend to have not four divided seasons. And the polar regions, while we can say they have four seasons, what they experience is not like, you know, where most of the humans live.
Right. So what you've been studying is seasonal change. And sort of the headline is that summers are getting longer, but there's a lot more to the story. So can you tell us about this research and what you found?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the way to begin is to say that, you know, we found in our research that, you know, warming from human-driven climate change has really dramatically changed the warmest season of the year. And in our case, I kind of like to liken it to how people might be perceiving the summer season. If you're like me, your perception of summer is that it is a different feel, a different vibe, a different experience than maybe when you were a child. And that was an impetus for doing this research. And so, you know, if you feel that way about summers, you're absolutely perceptive about that, because we found kind of three key things. One is that if you feel like summers feel like they last a long time, that is exactly what we found. We found that summers have been getting longer, and really that the number of days with summer conditions, and I can talk more about how we define that, yeah, is growing 1.5 times faster since the 1990s than prior than that. And so, talking about a couple specific places, if we want to talk about the Vancouver area, summers since 1990 are getting about 7 days every 10 years added to them. So every decade, summer lasts about 7 days longer, or in 40 years, about a month longer.
And that's quite a significant change. I mean, basically a week longer every 10 years is, yeah, huge.
Yes, yeah, it really is. And it's perceptible. That's what I'm saying. Like, we as humans are like, things feel different. And the nice thing is that the data backs that up. A couple of the other key findings are, if you're like me, it feels like summer just kind of abruptly appears. And then also, maybe at the tail end, you might be noticing that it feels like we go from kind of summer conditions to fall abruptly. And that is exactly what we found. We found that those shoulder seasons on either side of summer seem to be shrinking in terms of how long they last transitioning between these seasonal edges. And then the last thing is, if you feel like summers feel more intense, we also found that the data agrees with that, that the sort of buildup of heat during summer is rapidly growing. And also another way to think about that is, once it gets warm, it seems like it just kind of stays warm. And, you know, I remember that summers you'd have warm and then maybe you'd cool off a bit and then you'd get warm and you'd cool off, and that's how summer would be. And we just, seems like we're having less of that cooling off, and the data supports that.
It certainly seems to me that when I was young, we would get temperatures into the 30s just for a little bit in August. You know, now we're getting that starting in July, and of course we had that heat dome of huge temperatures in June.
Yeah.
You know, just a few years back.
Yeah. And, you know, we know that kind of the occurrence of heat waves, you know, it's heat, it tends to coincide in terms of really uncomfortable temperatures as happening in the warmer season. So, of course, if the warmer season itself is expanding, we're going to have the potential to see kind of those warm, warm heat waves earlier and earlier, and also later.
Yeah. What does it mean at the other part of the year? Because we've just gone through a winter that was pretty mild, no snowfall really to measure at all here in Vancouver. What does it mean for the winters?
Sure. Well, and so my research didn't look into winters, but, you know, others have. And we know that winters are actually kind of the research says that it's the fastest warming season. So the kind of the bottom temperatures are going up in winter. And so, you know, in terms of length and some of that other stuff, like other researchers have suggested that, you know, winters may be shrinking as well. But another way to think about that is, there are 365 days in the year. If summer is taking longer, everything else has to be shrinking.
Mm-hmm. So what's the significance of this beyond just, you know, more days at the beach?
Right. Yeah. And of course, I'm really sympathetic to the like, well, what's wrong with longer summers? Summers are great. That's when I go ride my bike. That's, you know, when I can dress a little, you know, lighter. I can spend more time outside. And while all of that is true, the summer season, and especially hotter and longer summer seasons, can be really disruptive to things that are sort of baked in terms of expectations of this nice gradual seasonal cycle with a predictable rhythm. Instead, earlier starting summers is going to impact quite a number of systems, like the food system. Think about when farmers plant their crops. The weather may be more conducive to planting, and in fact, maybe that last frost that they wait for before they get the stuff in the ground to start, you know, the growing season, that's going to happen earlier and earlier. But a challenge there is a lot of these crops rely on pollinators to pollinate them, and those pollinators may not be ready. But also true is the hours of daylight, those aren't shifting. So if you plant earlier, you may be planting and yet have, especially those of us in these northern latitudes, like you don't have a lot of daylight early on. And so that's going to adjust kind of how the whole food supply works. Other things are water supply. You think about how, you know, we hope for a nice snowpack in the Pacific Northwest that's going to be the battery of fresh water supply that we can draw on all throughout, you know, the spring and summer and into fall. And if we have rapid warming conditions early on, that snowmelt, whatever snow we manage to, you know, accumulate, it's going to melt quickly. And there's a couple downsides to that. It means that we're not going to have this gradual recharge of water supply, but also the ground is saturated and rapid snowmelt can lead to flooding. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple other things, but kind of the last piece that I'm especially worried about, because we're so used to the nice temperate conditions, say here in the Pacific Northwest, is that we're going to need cooling. The energy demand for cooling is going to go up, and people who never thought they needed an air conditioner, or maybe they got one because of the heat dome, you know, if they could afford it at the time, we're going to expend a lot of energy for cooling during the warm season. And something I'm concerned about there is that if you don't have an air conditioner, then, and you can afford it, you can get a heat pump. Now you've got an electrified system for both heating and cooling. That's great. But let's say you add an air conditioner and you continue with the gas furnace you have, you know, you're basically continuing a heating and cooling setup that is exacerbating the climate crisis.
So this change, because you mentioned 5 to 7 days occurring now, 50% faster than in the previous period you were you looked at before 1990.
Right.
So even that seems pretty quick. How does this kind of rate of change compare to other periods where we've seen climate change happen in the climate record?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, the climate scientists would remind us, and if anybody has seen the famous, you know, sort of hockey stick plot of how temperatures are changing, that we're seeing a temperature increase happening over a shorter span of time than ever in any records we have. You know, the Earth has been warmer than it is right now, but that was a very different looking Earth than it is now. And, you know, during a lot of those, especially warm periods, humans didn't have societies. We didn't have civilization. It was, you know, more ancient humans or, you know, our precursors that were surviving those conditions, and they migrated, you know, to be wherever was comfortable if they could. But, you know, we've got a society that's kind of set in place. We have cities where they are. One of the findings of this study is that the changes, the 5 to 7 days per decade average for the mid-latitudes, that is true even at coastal areas. So, you know, we think of Vancouver as a coastal area that's kind of moderated by the ocean, and many other coastal cities kind of have that same reputation. But we found that the growth in summer length, the growth in heat, the abrupt transitions, those are also happening at coastal margins. And so kind of the belief that coasts are not safe, but, you know, don't experience some of these changes is not borne out by this research.
Well, I think your research also indicated that the most dramatic numbers were actually over ocean areas.
That's true. So some of the changes were the most rapid over oceans. And when we talk about over oceans, we're talking about like the air just above the ocean surface. Yeah. That was a new thing about this study. Other people have looked at kind of just what's happening in the seasons over land, which makes sense. That's where people are. But the ocean, I mean, that covers a very large percentage of the planet, and it controls a lot of the weather.
Do you understand yet whether why that is, why it's more dramatic over the oceans?
I don't have results on sort of root cause. I'm hoping, you know, that this research kind of drives people who are have more expertise in those kinds of things to go, that is an interesting and important finding. Let's see if we can talk about why. Some of that, of course, is that if I had to guess, it's that we know that 90% of the heat from, you know, climate warming is actually going into the ocean. The oceans are absorbing that, and then kind of the great circulation that happens in the ocean pushing those temperatures down. But if the ocean surfaces are getting warmer and warmer, kind of the efficiency of that temperature exchange may lose power, you know? And so some of the summers rising rapidly thing, maybe it's an indication that there's something going on there, but I'm hoping that some ocean researchers will dive into that.
Right. And this seems like a really lay person friendly measure of climate change, because when I read about it, I thought it was really interesting to think about what your sort of personal experience, knowing that things have changed and seeing that sort of quantified in a way. How do you think this can help people understand what's going on in the world?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think that it is really important to do science, especially climate science, that kind of feels relevant. And, you know, whether it challenges our perceptions or it supports our perceptions, it's part of things that we can understand without, you know, advanced expertise. So that is a big motivation in doing this kind of climate science. As to what it kind of can do for people, the nice thing about this is, because it does match a lot of people's perceptions, it is a way of relating to the climate that is very different from hearing the climate is warmer, debates about is it 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer, or is it 1.4 warmer, like those kinds.
And I know
of,
for myself, I hear those numbers, but it's hard to place that into what does that mean.
Yeah, really.
The way I experience or understand.
Exactly. Yeah, and really, like a small gradual temperature change isn't really all that perceptible to us. You know, even a day being 1 degree warmer than the previous day, we don't really notice that. But things like seasonal changes, things that really are, you know, kind of part of our day in, day out. You know, when do kids go to school? You think about like fall sports. If fall sports happen at the same time as they've always happened, they may happen at times that are extremely warm and dry. And so now we're putting kids and adults out, you know, in challenging weather to do those sports. And there are going to be human health risks with that. Same as with spring sports. I used to be a coach of cross-country running in the fall and track and field in the spring. And in both cases, our sports seasons were interrupted by warmer temperatures, forest fire smoke, you know, things that we had to really adjust. But the system, like when the sports happened, that was really fixed. Like we always had the season at that time. And so these are some of the things that are going to get potentially disrupted, and disrupted quite a bit.
So are you planning to continue on research in this area, and where do you hope this leads?
Yeah, absolutely. So I hope that, you know, for example, we talked about oceans. I hope it spurs some others to trying to look into some of the root causes. People who are kind of more driven to understand, say, the physics of the why in some of these things. Not that I don't like that stuff, but I do really like maintaining the connection to kind of general human experience. Right. But one of the things that is important is I found these trends. The trends are pretty, you know, pretty good averages across all of the mid-latitudes. There were a few outlier cities. For example, Sydney, Australia is experiencing twice the growth of summer length as, say, Vancouver, you know, or 1.5 times as fast as Toronto. So there are places that are kind of outliers. But what we need to know is we'd like to say, are these trends going to continue? You know, and we could say that we could extrapolate these trends, but that's not necessarily reliable. We know that it's risky to say, well, it's been doing this, so it's going to keep on doing that. That's not necessarily safe. And so we have tools for understanding how the climate may change in the future, and those are called climate models. And so my hope is to use climate model data, climate models we can actually look at how they run backwards. So in other words, do they predict over the same kind of 1990 to 2023 period the same changes? Mm-hmm. And if they do, then I can use and look at that forward. And so I can use climate model output to see, well, are these trends going to continue? Are they going to change? What do we expect based on the level of emissions? That's the other nice thing about climate change or climate models, is that we can say, well, if humans do this, then what is likely to happen? And so that's kind of the next piece of my research, is to try and understand what's going to happen in the future.
Great. So what inspired, just sort of finishing up here, what inspired you to sort of focus your academic studies on climate change?
Yeah, right.
Studies.
I was, before I started at UBC, I was a high school teacher down in the Seattle area, and I was teaching science and math classes, and I taught an earth science class. But in general, it was really palpable how concerned adolescents are about climate change. You know, they're like, they want to know, like, are we in trouble? Am I doomed? What's the point? You know, especially in adolescence, there's a certain level of cynicism, a certain level of distrust that, like, the grown-ups are actually going to fix the problem. Do they have to fix the problem? And what a burden that places on them. And it really kind of impressed upon me that I had a kind of a desire to get back into university level education, but in terms of like what was the problem that really attracted me to dive into more, their level of concern and my own concern. I have a daughter who attends the University of Victoria, and you know, I want her to have a world to grow up into, and you know, to not be as burdened by what's happening with the climate. So if I can do research that helps, you know, raise the issue, raise the priority, get politicians to start making decisions that help moving us in the right direction, then that's where I want to be.
Great. Well, thank you for doing this research and talking to me today. It's very interesting. And like I say, it's sort of it sort of puts a number on something almost all of us have experienced or felt, you know, looking backwards to our own younger days. And it feels quite meaningful to have an actual number on that you know, puts into context what we've experienced.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on, Magnus. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks so much, Ted Scott, PhD student in the UBC Department of Geography. And you're coming up on a big milestone in your current studies, yeah?
That's true. I've got my PhD qualifying exams starting tomorrow.
Great. And then how much longer before you would complete your program?
I'm hoping to be done within the next 2 years.
Excellent. Well, good luck with all that.
Thank you.
Maybe perhaps we'll be talking to you again soon on some more research you're doing. That'd be great.
That'd be great. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Ted Scott from UBC Department of Geography. Thanks for speaking to us today.
This is Bird Note. Rachel Carson, the author of Silent Spring, had a really serious relationship with a woman named Dorothy Freeman. They wrote love letters to each other. And in those letters, they wrote a lot about one bird that became really special to them, the veery, a type of thrush. The veery is pretty plain looking, but it has a particularly beautiful song. Hearing that song and hearing it together became kind of a quest for the two women. Here's an excerpt from one of Carson's early letters to Freeman.
I think it is quite possible for you and me and the veeries to be together in some magical time and place next June.
Carson and Freeman lived many states apart, but the veeries brought them together, despite the distance.
As I learned the other day, while I was in Rock Creek Park, listening to veeries and wishing for you, you were walking along your road, listening to wood thrushes and wishing for me.
You can hear the full story about Rachel Carson's love for Dorothy Freeman and the veeries on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Liza Yeager.
Ihr hört Mike mit Noise of Corporate right here on CJSF 90.1 FM and CJSF.ca. Hello, this is Arne Peltner, host of Radio Goethe. You're listening to Mike and his Noise of Corporate, celebrating the indie noises of the 90s on CJSF 90.1 FM and CJSF.ca.
This is a CHY News update. It's been over a month since a year-round drop-in service hub closed in downtown Nanaimo, leaving many community services looking for a new way to keep those living on the street from falling through the cracks. CHY first reported on the upcoming closure of the hub back in March. It was a low-barrier space located at 55 Victoria Road that gave street-entrenched people access to essential services such as food, clothing, and hygiene items, and connections with community resources. Run 7 days a week, the hub was operated by Island Crisis Care Society, or ICCS, in partnership with Nanaimo Family Life Association, or NFLA. The daytime service, run by ICCS, was funded by the City of Nanaimo and supported by the federal government via United Way BC through the Reaching Home program. The nighttime service that was run by NFLA was funded by BC Housing. This closure came as many residents in the nearby neighborhood reported an increase in social disorder after the hub had first opened. This led Nanaimo City Council to vote in the summer of 2025 to end the city's funding for the hub's daytime services. Erica Gagnon, Director of Shelters and Guest Services for the Nanaimo Family Life Association, says NFLA, ICCS, and the City of Nanaimo are still looking for a new location for the hub.
In over 6 months, we've been looking for a location. Visiting potential sites has slowed right down, not because we're not interested in finding a site. We absolutely still need a site. We still have everyone invested in getting another hub up and running. But we have looked at 30 properties so far, so we've kind of exhausted the inventory that is out there.
She says all three groups have been looking for a new location since well before the former hub space closed. But all the places they have looked at have not been appropriate due to location or the need for significant upgrades or alterations, something they cannot afford.
And so as new properties come on the market, ourselves, ICCS, the city, we all have a running email. We're all sending each other new real estate. We have great real estate teams. There's just no other inventory out there that would be appropriate for us to look at this time.
Along with running the nighttime shelter at the hub, NFLA also runs a year-round Unitarian shelter and the emergency winter shelter at St. Peter's Church that was also closed for the season at the end of March.
So for the people that are seeking shelter, it's not been going well. The shelters are full every night. The few beds that are available, people are checking in with us. Of course, we're connecting with a lot of people because they're coming to our shelter, and of course we're full. They are sleeping in doorways, they're sleeping in tents, they're sleeping in parks.
To help those who are now needing to find shelter elsewhere, Gagnon says they have been handing out as much survival equipment as they can during their shower program weekdays at Caledonia Park. She says now that the hub is closed, she's concerned that those who have came to see the hub as a safe and warm space will fall through the cracks.
I think a lot of the community looked at it as somewhere that someone who was addicted or unhoused could go and get a coffee, get a sandwich, a new pair of socks. But truly, somewhere like the hub keeps people alive until hopefully they have a moment of clarity or there is an opportunity from, you know, a medical organization or to get them the help that they want.
She says the loss of the hub is a loss of a channel for service providers to connect with those in need.
For instance, yesterday I left the office here and there was someone who needed some transportation passes and a very important message about a medical appointment. And we went and hunted them down in the bushes because we know this person. We know this. They need the services that were being offered. They were seeking out these services, but we had no way to connect with them. And so that's what a lot of agencies are doing right now because they're, you know, you're in this line of work because you want to help, but there's no way to connect with those people now. And so you're left with, you can either write it down and hope they show up, or you can go and find them in a lot.
While also continuing to look for a new hub location, Island Crisis Care Society has started looking at other ways they can support those living on the street.
We have secured a van, and so we're going to be offering mobile outreach. We're calling it our mobile hub, but we'll be offering all the same services that the hub provided. So we're doing some food work, food service, providing food, harm reduction supplies, clothing, looking to have opportunities to set up a tent and a table and do some of the work with. Some of the things we did were like helping with documentation, things for like appointments.
That was Ted Paul, the new executive director for ICCS. He told CHY that as the mobile hub is only starting this week, they're still working through where and when the van will be out. But for now, their main focus is to service those downtown.
What we looked at was there's a calendar out there of every